Today is Monday, August 21st. It's Eclipse Day. We're going to have a short class covering pH scale and inorganic compounds.
Okay, so page 14 is going to start for us inorganic compounds. We're going to take a look at those today. There's a lot of stuff in grocery stores nowadays about organic foods, and I want to kind of dispel something here that organic foods and organic compounds really mean two different things. You know, the grocery store advertises organic foods as being those grown organically without things like pesticides. But when we're talking about organic compounds, what do we really mean? They contain
carbon, hydrogen, oxygen,
exactly. So our definition in this class for the word organic is different from the grocery store's definition for organic. To differentiate between organic and inorganic, I'll give you a moment to jot down these notes if you would like. Our inorganic compounds are typically ionically bonded together. We typically do not see long chains of carbons and hydrogens in our inorganic compounds. And inorganic compounds may or may not be made by living organisms. I do want to emphasize the use of words like usually and typically, because we're not looking at a hard and fast rule here. We look at most of our inorganic compounds fitting this bill, but not all of them do. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this screen. I can talk, it's Monday. Y'all good, okay. So like I mentioned, you know, a lot of our inorganic compounds lack long chains of carbons and hydrogens. And what we mean by that is, in the picture on the right, there's lots of carbons and hydrogens all linked covalently. That's typical of what you see in an organic molecule, like a carb or a lipid. But in this picture on the left, you'll notice this inorganic compound does not have those long chains of carbons and hydrogens. That's one of the best ways to differentiate between an inorganic molecule and an organic molecule, is looking at the chemical structure and noticing that there are not those long chains of carbons and hydrogens in those inorganic compounds. Okay, so what I'd like to do is talk to you about an exception to the rule. Water is a great example of an inorganic compound. It fits, well, almost none of the rules. So let's go back and look at our rules for just a moment. We know that typically inorganic molecules are ionically compounded together and they lack long chains of carbons and hydrogens. Well, when you look at a water molecule, they're not ionically compounded or bonded together. What in fact does hold together your oxygen and hydrogens? What kind of bonds? Yeah, covalent bonds, good. So, in fact, we have covalent bonding in this inorganic molecule, and that breaks rule number one. Let's take a look at rule number two. Most of our inorganic compounds lack hydrogens and carbons. Do you see long chains of hydrogens and carbons in our water molecule? Okay, so we fit that bill for what an inorganic molecule is. We don't see the long chains of carbons and hydrogen atoms bonded here. Okay. So, you know, basic chemistry, you know, in an A&P course seems kind of an odd discussion. Why are we talking about water in an A&P course? We'll die without the water. Most of our bodies are made up of water. In fact, in a baby, 80% of a baby's body is water. You know, adults, 60-something percent is water. And by the time you're in your 80s, you're looking at around 50% of your body being made of water. So yeah, that's why we talk about water in this course. It's certainly a big role for the way our bodies work. So it is not just a covalent bond that holds together the hydrogens to the oxygen. What specific type holds those hydrogens and oxygen together?
Polar,
yeah. This is a polar covalent molecule. Good. Okay, so tell me what you know about polar covalent bonds. Unequally shared. Right, good. In the water molecule, do you remember which atom is the greedy one, taking more than its fair share?
Oxygen.
Good, good. Okay. So oxygen has a delta negative that represents it's taking more than its fair share of time with those electrons. These hydrogens have a delta positive because they lose part of their time with those electrons. The electrons actually orbit that oxygen nucleus more frequently. So that actually takes care of our first thing on the list there, polarity. Polarity is a descriptor for water molecules, and it has to do with the unequal sharing between the electrons housed around the oxygen nucleus and around the hydrogen nucleus. So polarity is also the reason that oil and water don't get along. Water happens to be a polar covalent bonded molecule, and oil is nonpolar. So this will again make for an interesting story when we have to figure out how does oil and water behave together in our bodies. Water molecules also tend to stick together, and that is thanks to a special type of bond known as a hydrogen bond. Good. So how does hydrogen bonding work?
It's a weak polar bond. It's a weak bond in two different atoms.
Good. A weak bond, it's a weak attraction, and the critical thing you've got to have for a hydrogen bond is two polar molecules. So the hydrogen shares a weak attraction to a delta negative on a neighboring molecule. So you'll notice these hydrogens have delta positives, and their weak attraction is to something with a delta negative. You've heard the old story, right? Opposites attract. That's what's going on here, is hydrogen with a partial positive charge is attracted to a neighboring molecule with a slightly negative charge. I have this thing in my mind, I gotta share it with you, because I think it really sums up how hydrogen bonding works. Let's say that two couples go to the movies, okay? Everything looks happy on the surface, right? But secretly, you know what's happening, right? Two of the parties are actually interested in each other. So that's kind of what's happening here. You've got couples, you know, and you've got a guy and a girl in this relationship that are actually secretly attracted to each other. That's kind of what a hydrogen bond is. So everybody looks like a happy family in the water molecule. This one looks happy too, but there's this secret attraction that goes between those opposites and those neighboring molecules. That's what a hydrogen bond is. It's that secret attraction. What's that?
I said that's a bomb waiting to happen.
That is a bomb waiting to happen, yeah. But these water molecules, they keep their secrets so nobody ever knows, right? Okay, that takes us to the next topic there, which is a high heat capacity about halfway down your page. Okay, so we've got the hot summer heat right now. You go outside on a 100-degree day. Thank you, water molecules, for hydrogen bonding, because this creates what's called a high heat capacity. What this means is it takes a certain amount of energy to heat up the water in your body to the point of becoming a gas. So good news is you're not going to walk outside on a 100-degree day and instantly turn into a vaporized cloud of gas. Likewise, go outside on a really cold winter day and you don't turn into an ice block. It takes a certain amount of energy to either heat up the water to a gaseous state or to freeze it down to a block of ice state, basically. You're probably already familiar with this concept. If you go to the beach or a lake or any kind of body of water in, say, May, June, cold water, right? Okay, that's high heat capacity. There's a lag time for that body of water to heat up. Likewise, if you go to the beach in, say, October, where the air temperature is cooled off, that water is still warm thanks to that high heat capacity. So water does tend to have a cushioning effect in terms of being resistant to temperature changes. That is good for your bottom line, because our bottom line is maintaining what?
Homeostasis.
Good. And on average, what is the typical body temperature? 98.6 on the Fahrenheit scale. Anyone know the Celsius scale? Yeah, good, 37. Yeah, around 37. So that is all about homeostasis for us. Good. Okay, water is also great as a chemical reactant. In fact, we call it our universal solvent. It helps perform a number of chemical reactions in our bodies. And finally there, a little bit about cushioning in our bodies. You know, we don't normally think about water as being a cushioning device. We normally think of fat playing that role. But water actually serves as a cushioning around your brain, your spinal cord. It cushions around your eye. It cushions around your heart and lungs. So there's a lot of really good places for water to serve as a cushioning device in your body. What is the number one location, though, for water to be stored?
In the cells.
In the cells, good. Around two-thirds or 66% of your bodily fluids are stored inside cells. What do we call that fluid?
Intracellular,
good. And to abbreviate intracellular, we call it?
ICF,
good. Okay, so intracellular fluid is the number one storage location for fluids in your body. That makes up around two-thirds of your bodily fluids. The other fluids in your body are found outside your cells. Those fluids are called extracellular fluids, and that includes places like interstitial fluids between your cells and tissues, or in fact, even fluid in your bloodstream. There we call it plasma. So that extracellular fluid is only around one-third of your bodily fluids. I think this is a staggering number. You have somewhere between, it's something like 23 and 27 liters of fluid in your body. You know, if you think about a 2-liter bottle of a soft drink, and you think about having 27 liters in your body, that's a lot of water. No wonder we're so heavy, right? We're toting around a lot of water. So most of it is stored inside the cells. The rest of it's between cells and tissues and in your blood plasma. So, you know, we have a certain amount that we can lose before we start getting thirsty to replace those lost fluids. You'll want to highlight that on your paper. The number one storage location for water is intracellular fluid. You'll want to highlight that. The number one storage location for water in your body is intracellular fluid. Inside cells. Do you have questions on that page? So let's see, to be an inorganic compound means that you are likely bonded in what way?
Ionic.
Ionic, good. And you probably lack a bunch of atoms that are in the carbon and hydrogen arena. So now we're looking at a category of inorganic compounds that we call electrolytes. And if you're on the top of page 15 with me, that's where I'm going to start you off. So the word electrolyte has the word electrical hidden in it, and that's because electrolytes can conduct electricity in water. And you think about our bodies, and you don't necessarily think of us zapping ourselves or one another, so it's actually muscles and nerves that do the electrical conduction. Okay, so some common electrolytes that we're going to look at are actually cations and anions that result from the breakup of an ionic bond. And in this category, we place things like acids, bases, and salts. Okay, so notice water is not considered an electrolyte. It doesn't contain those cations and anions necessary for the conduction of electricity. So we don't consider water to be a great source of electrolytes. You knew that though, right? Okay, so if you've had the diarrhea and vomiting flu and you feel like, ugh, you know, the way to replace your electrolytes is not by drinking water. What do you drink instead?
Gatorade,
yeah. Pedialyte, Gatorade. Chicken noodle soup is a good source too, yeah, but not water. right, some common cations and anions that we'll discuss throughout Bio-210 and 211 are these. What is that first cation, Na?
Sodium.
Sodium, good. And Ca, the next one?
Calcium.
Good. What is that little plus symbol up at the upper right hand?
It's a positive charge.
Positive charge. Cation. And has it lost or gained electrons?
Lost.
Lost, yeah. So if it has a single plus, that means you lost one electron. If you've got two plus, that means you've lost two electrons, yeah. How about the next one, K plus?
Potassium,
good. And Mg?
Magnesium.
Magnesium, good. So we're going to talk a lot about these common cations as we go through 210 and 211. And down below, you've got anions like chlorine and a polyatomic anion like bicarbonate and phosphate. You don't have to memorize the list. You're going to see these often enough throughout 210 and 211 that this becomes part of your conversation. Checking to see if anybody needs this screen. Okay. So you may wonder why, when a person has, say, vomiting and diarrhea, or perhaps excessive sweating, we're concerned about their loss of electrolytes. Well, we need electrolytes in order for your cells to work properly, especially muscle cells and nerve cells. You know how bad you feel if you've had vomiting and diarrhea? You feel very weak. That's because your electrolytes are necessary to make sure your muscles and nerves work properly. So we also look at hydration and osmosis as being driven by electrolytes. So another good reason to maintain electrolyte balance is to make sure that you hold on to the water that your body has. Most of that water, in fact, is stored where?
Inside the cells.
Inside the cells, good. So our first subcategory of electrolytes are considered to be salts. And you'll notice here that salts are inorganic. They are ionically bonded. They don't contain a lot of carbons or hydrogens. In fact, they also don't contain hydrogens or hydroxides. So we kind of use them as the junk category where we place those electrolytes that do not categorize as an acid or a base. So if you look at the list here, you may find some of those cations off the previous list and the anions. They've come back here to visit us once again. But what you don't see are long chains of carbons and what?
And hydrogens,
yeah. So by not seeing long chains of carbons and hydrogens, what can you say about these salt examples? They're inorganic, yeah. There's no long chain, so they're inorganic, not organic. That's what differentiates those two groups. Good. So you probably are familiar with table salt, the first one listed there, NaCl. And we kind of get in our minds that that is the only salt in the world, but in fact, there are others that fit in this category. And you don't necessarily want to put them on your food, but you know, salt is a really broad general category that includes chemical compounds that are ionically bonded, don't have hydrogens, carbons, or even hydroxides. So they're not acids, they're not bases, they're considered to be some type of ionically bonded chemical compounds, not organic in nature either. So let's now turn our attention to acids and bases. Let's talk about acids first. On your worksheet it says these are substances that donate or release what? Hydrogens, good. So when you place an acid in water, you should release hydrogen ions into solution. On the pH scale, where should we find our acids?
Anything below 7.
Below 7, good. So the closer you go to 0, what does that tell you about the acid?
The more acidic it is.
More acidic it is, good. It's a stronger acid. In fact, if you had the opposite direction back here towards 7, what does that tell you?
It becomes more basic.
More basic, yeah, less acidic, good. What is special about number seven?
Number seven is a neutral line.
Neutral, good. Neither acidic nor basic, good. Okay. Some examples of acids in the human body. Can you think of a few?
Stomach acid,
that's a good one.
Urine,
another good one.
Saliva.
Can give us three great ones to work with. Stomach acids, urine, saliva. So on your worksheet, you'll notice HCl, and there's an arrow, and then you see hydrogen ion plus a chlorine ion. So that illustrates to us that when you have HCl or hydrochloric acid in water, it's going to break apart and give you hydrogen ions and the chlorine ions. So if you don't know too much of the background about chemistry, let me give you a real helpful shortcut. You'll notice HCl has an H in the front, right? Okay, that H is saying to you, hey, I'm an acid. I put my H in the front, so it says to you, hey, I release hydrogens when you put me in water. The exception to this rule, of course, is water. H2O has the H in the front, but water's not an acid. What is water?
Neutral.
Yeah, it's neutral. So something like H2SO4 would be an acid. There again is that H right there in the front of the compound that's saying to you, hey, I'm an acid. H's go in the front for acids. Okay, let's talk about bases for just a moment. You'll notice that bases don't release hydrogens in water. In fact, they release something called a hydroxide or a hydroxyl ion. And that is what two atoms?
Hydrogen
and oxygen. Good. And in this case, notice NaOH is our example. When it breaks apart in water, what does it release?
It releases sodium and oxygen.
Yeah, and that oxygen-hydrogen combination is what we're looking for. OH is called a hydroxyl or a hydroxide ion. And in compounds, the OH is at the rear end. Okay, so if you see NaOH or KOH or LiOH, that OH at the rear end of the compound says to you, hey, I'm a base. All right, some examples in our bodies include what?
Blood's
a great one. That's good. Semen's another one. Pancreatic juices is another. Okay, blood, semen, pancreatic juices. All right, and on our pH scale, where are bases located?
Above seven,
good. So let me caution you here, because it's not 8 and above that's a base, it's anything above 7. 7.0 is considered neutral. 7.1 is considered a base. So to say above 7 is probably the best way to word it. That way you catch everything from 7.1 all the way to 14. Likewise, when you talk about acids, it's probably better to say below 7 because 6.9 all the way down to 0 is considered an acidic solution on our pH scale. The extremes, 0 at one end and 14 at the other end, are where we find our strongest acids and bases. Closest to 7 there in the very center is where we find our weakest acids and bases. On your worksheet down there on below, you notice there's the pH scale fast facts. Let's hit those. All right, it says the pH scale is a measure of how many hydrogen ions you have in solution. That's what the H in pH stands for. You'll notice the next blank says that 7 is neutral. What it means to be neutral is that you release equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyls. You release equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyls. this is kind of cool. I thought you'd like to see that hydrogens and hydroxyls, when added together at 7, give us H2O. There's one of the hydrogens in the H2O, and the other one comes from the hydroxyl. So right at 7.0, about the only thing we have at 7.0 is water. Even the tap water at home is slightly acidic at around 6.7 to 6.9. So that means that our tap water that comes through the rocks in our ground around here is actually slightly acidic. But, you know, neutral distilled water should be right at 7.0.
Like the water you get, like a bottle?
Bottled water should be neutralized, yeah. It should have all that other stuff taken out of it. Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the this thing now that comes out with alkaline water that you drink more alkaline water?
As far as I can tell, I don't think that does a whole lot for us, because breaking down proteins, like if you eat any kind of protein-based food in your diet, eat whether it's rice and beans or actual meat, it makes your body acidic, and your kidneys excrete that acid into the urine. I don't know that drinking a metabolic water that is actually basic is going to do a whole lot to counteract those effects. Probably. I don't know that there's been a whole lot of research, but that seems to be very popular.
It is. I'll
do some reading and see if there's any scientific proof to back that up. Yeah. But as far as I can tell, it's probably just a... Yeah. It's just a gimmick. Hey, let's sell this, you know?
Yeah.
Let's see. On the pH scale, it's based on a log of 10. And you'll notice that because down here, they've got this log of 10 all the way across the very bottom. But for our conversation, we just want to appreciate that every whole number you move is a tenfold change in the strength of the acid or the base. So if we're talking about coffee, for instance, you know, some people like their coffee really strong. If you've got coffee with a pH of 5, it's actually 10 times less acidic than a coffee with a pH of 4. You never have to work with negatives. All you have to do is flip-flop your language. And instead of saying, you know, it in a negative way, all I'd have to say is pH of 4 is 10 times stronger of an acid or releases 10 times more hydrogens than a pH of 5. Yeah. One thing I want to kind of put out there to caution you is it's not adding 10 plus 10. It's multiplying 10 times 10. Yeah. So if we now say compare coffee with a pH of 5 to a pH of 3, what's the difference in strength? The difference in strength between a pH of 5 and 3? Don't add them, but multiply them. It's 100 times difference. Let me give you a real easy way to do this. Okay, so if I'm looking at a pH of 5 and I ask you, hey, how much stronger is a pH of 3? Just set it up so you can do a subtraction. 5 minus 3 is, of course, 2. And that's going to be my superscript. Not everybody likes to work with superscripts. So another way to do this is say 2 is the number of zeros that I've got. There they are. So a 5 pH is 100 times weaker than 3. Or it's 100 times less acidic than 3. Or you can flip-flop it and say that 3 is 100 times more acidic than 5. Okay? Let me give you another one to work with. Let's compare 5 to a pH of 1. Pitch a 4 there. That's your superscript. Let's see. Let's 1, 2, 3, 4. Yep. So 1 is actually 10,000 times stronger than 5. Flip-flop your language, 5 is 10,000 times weaker than 1.
So what acids besides stomach acid would fall in a pH of 1?
That's mainly it in our bodies. That is the strongest thing we've got. The bottom of your page has a couple of practice problems. I'm going to let you guys work on those as a homework, and we can review those in class on Wednesday. What we're going to do Wednesday is I'm going to flip you over to page, say, 17, work on some chemical reactions. What's your comfort level with organic compounds like carbs and lipids and all that stuff? Okay. Why don't we do that Wednesday? Wednesday we'll work on those chemical reactions and we'll do the organic compounds, and that's probably going to take up the entire class period on Wednesday. Okay? And then of course Monday looks like we will get started with cell information. Y'all good to go? Got any questions for today? I would, because that would be helpful on page 16. It sure would.